calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Labor was the first price, the original purchase, the money that was paid for all things, wrote Adam Smith in 1776, the author of Wealth of Nations. Our quote for the day, labor, it was not by gold or silver, he says, but by labor that all wealth of the world was originally purchased. Adam Smith, our quote for the day. Coming up in the program, we're going to be talking about the Murtha effect and why the Republicans are running scared. Why aren't corporations paying for their fair share of the commons? Is the Republicans' new leader, Mr. Boehner's landlord, a lobbyist? Boehner, whatever. You'll be surprised. I was in London over the weekend. They all referred to him as Mr. Boehner. Apparently, that's the correct pronunciation. And our question for this hour, has Alan Greenspan set up this country for another Great Depression? With us, we have Ravi Batra. He's a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, and his website, Ravi Batra, RAVIBATRA.com. And he's also the author of a book that I recommended in my BuzzFlash recommended books. You can still find him over at BuzzFlash.com, a book review of it. And I still continue to think it's probably one of the best books on economics that's been written in the last couple of years, Greenspan's Fraud. Professor Ravi Batra, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot.
So happy to have you with us. Greenspan has left. He's been replaced now with a fellow that, by and large, it seems like the economic community thinks is, kind of milquetoast. It's nothing to worry about, all that sort of thing. And I want to get into your thoughts on his replacement in just a moment. But first of all, what has Alan Greenspan, you know, he's been, everybody is lauding him, praising him. Not my sense of your take on him.
Not at all. I think I can't find anything that he has done great for the U.S. economy or even the world economy. I mean, people keep saying that he maintained low inflation and full employment in the country, but then where is inflation high in the world? Inflation is low everywhere in the world. It's not just Greenspan who did it. Everybody else did the same thing. And then yes, employment has been high, more or less high during his tenure, but high employment in a low-wage economy is not a big deal. Wages have been falling down during his tenure, and that is not a big deal because low wages will always lead to higher unemployment. The achievement is when you have rising wages and high employment, and that's when occurred in the times prior to Greenspan, in the 50s and the 60s, even in the 70s sometimes, we had rising real wages and high employment at the same time. Greenspan did not do that.
Yeah, in fact, Alan Greenspan was quoted in the late 90s in the Wall Street Journal as saying that he felt that part of his job responsibility was to maintain a certain level of worker insecurity. The goal apparently being to prevent people from unionizing and prevent what he called wage inflation.
That's incredible.
It's true though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is true. It certainly is true. He would raise interest rates whenever he thought that wages were rising too fast, and in the process, he single-handedly created a stock market bubble. People don't realize what his contribution was to the stock market bubble. See, whenever wages lag behind productivity is rising but wages are not rising by much, that means profits will rise very sharply.
And which increases the value of stocks.
Exactly. You don't have stock market bubbles appearing every decade. Something special has to be done to bring them about, and this was Greenspan's doing.
So it wasn't Bill Clinton's fault, like the Republicans like to say?
It was all Greenspan's monetary policy. His policy made sure that wages did not rise much while productivity was going up. Profits had to rise year after year. As a result, there was bubble. And then the bubble crashed. He also caused the bubble to crash. See, in 1999, in the middle of the stock market bubble, he began raising interest rates, forgetting the history lesson from Japan. Japan had done the same thing in 1989, raised interest rates, and then within a year, their market crashed. Within a year of Greenspan raising interest rates, the market crashed here also.
Yeah, yeah. And then George W. Bush wanted to get reelected, and Greenspan, being a good conservative, said, okay, well, I know you're borrowing like crazy, we're ruining the American economy, but we're going to make it look good. So he drove interest rates down into what actually, when compared to inflation, was negative interest rates.
Oh,
interest
yeah.
rates were below the rate of inflation, and that caused the housing bubble.
Right. So this is what Greenspan keeps doing. He creates problems. And people give him credit for solving those problems. All he does is bring interest rates down and create more debt in the economy, which means the problem is there. We'll get even worse in the long run. So now he's gone, but he's leaving behind a huge housing bubble. He's leaving behind a huge trade deficit in the country. Poverty, you know, 38 million people living below poverty line, that's the all-time high. So I can't really find anything good that he did, and that's why I wrote the book, Greenspan's Fraud. He's getting credit, whereas he's really fraudulent, he also did the Social Security scam. Thanks for writing about that.
Yeah, and I want to get to that next, in fact. We're talking with Ravi Batra. He is a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University and the author of what you need to run out to the bookstore and buy right now, not just because it's about Greenspan, but because it's really a wonderful book on macro and microeconomics, Greenspan's Fraud by Ravi Batra. And his website, ravibatra.com, ravibatra.com. And Ravi Batra, we have, I don't know, we got 4 minutes or so here. What Greenspan did to Social Security, probably we could take a half hour to talk about it, but in a snapshot, in a thumbnail, what's the deal here?
Well,
his big fraud.
In the early 80s, Reagan had cut the income tax sharply. That caused a big increase in the federal deficit, and that was creating lots of problems in the economy. So Greenspan came up with a scam that we should raise the Social Security tax or payroll tax. And the whole
Didn't just raise it, he doubled it.
He sharply raised it. I think it was big rise in the social payroll tax. And so he said, we'll create a savings account for the retirees, we'll guarantee their future benefits, and that savings, the surplus money from the tax will pay their future benefits. But the whole purpose of raising the tax was to reduce the federal deficit, which initially had been caused by the cut in the income tax. So we should not be surprised now that there is absolutely zero money in that surplus trust fund. And all the money, extra money that the government collected has been raised to finance the income tax cuts of the wealthy. That's Greenspan's scam, because it was his idea. Nobody else's idea. He was the chairman of the Greenspan Commission, which came up with the idea.
Yeah, and so let me just get this straight. We're talking with Ravi Batra, a world-class economist, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University. Ronald Reagan comes along with this crackpot idea that his own vice president called voodoo economics,
right,
that if you dramatically slash, if you take from 70%, the top marginal tax rate, income tax rate on millionaires and billionaires, and drop it down to in the high 20s, low 30s, that's going to somehow increase the amount of money that comes into government. Doesn't make any sense. Reagan believes it. He does it. And sure enough, it doesn't work. It cuts the amount of money coming in. So Greenspan says, okay, and all of a sudden Reagan is like looking like a fool, and the government is going into debt, and it could create a crisis. So Greenspan says, here's the solution. Let's hit the average working Joe, because millionaires and billionaires don't pay Social Security taxes after the first, back then it was the first $60,000 of your income, as I recall. He said, let's just jack up, let's almost double the taxes on the average working person by increasing the Social Security tax. We'll create this giant surplus, we'll call it the trust fund, and then we'll borrow from that, and because it's not borrowing from a foreign country, it won't show up on the deficit. And this is going on right to this day. George W. Bush just said that our debt is only going to be, what, 300 and some odd, 400 and some odd billion dollars, but it's actually $200 billion higher because he's borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund.
Exactly. I mean, this is a big scam. They are using up this money and fooling the public at the same time. But people think that all parties are involved. A lot of Democrats and Republicans are involved in the scam. But if you look at history, the scam was his idea, Greenspan's idea. I mean, nobody else was smart enough or cunning enough to offer this idea. He's the one who offered it, and that's why it's Greenspan's Fraud and nobody else's.
Yeah, and thus the title of your book, Ravi Batra, Greenspan's Fraud, which, you know, I can't say it enough. I really loved that book. I couldn't put it down. And it's not a geeky economic book. I mean, you know, it's anybody can read this book and all of a sudden understand not only, you know, how economics works at a national level and international level, but also, you know, what Alan Greenspan's contribution and Ronald Reagan's contribution
to
this was
as well.
Yeah, and
then Greenspan constantly opposed the minimum wage. I have shown in the book that a rising minimum wage actually raises employment in the economy, does not cut it. Every time there is minimum wage in the country, employment went up. Every time.
Well said. Ravi Batra, R-A-V-I-B-A-T-R-A, the website. He's the author of the book Greenspan's Fraud. Go out and pick up a copy. In fact, get three and share the other two with your friends. Ravi Batra, Dr. Batra, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Great speaking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you. Only you can let it in. No one else.
And welcome back, my friends. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle or the left or the progressive, whatever you want to call it. The real progressive talk show host, Tom Hartman, here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Ravi Batra, thank you for coming back on the program. I realized that the two questions that I started the show with, I never got around to asking, and I really wanted to know the answers. Thanks for sticking around with us.
Okay.
Number one, has Alan Greenspan set us up for another Great Depression? I mean, things seem pretty bad right now, a debt that's off the scale. Are we, you know, do we need to batten down the hatches?
I think I wouldn't be surprised. He has been postponing the economic problems to the future, and the future is not that far off, I think. There could be another Great Depression in the country. This bursting of the housing bubble could be one, but I don't think the bursting is coming right away.
Mm-hmm.
It perhaps could take another year or two before it bursts. And the interest rates themselves are not rising much. They I don't think, will cause a bursting of the bubble, but the rising oil price could kill confidence in the country, and that could kill the housing bubble. And then when that happens, so much of the bubble is financed by foreigners. They are lending us money, and they will lose a lot of their principal. The investors, the private foreign investors, will start losing money. When that happens, they will be run away from the dollar. That could cause a big rise in interest rates, and then that will be the start of the depression.
Now, if that happens, if my understanding of macroeconomics is right, and you tell me, it seems that would mean that the value of the dollar, at least in international terms, would be decreasing as we have inflation.
It will fall very sharply.
Right.
And Greenspan has seen to it that we don't have much industry left in our country.
Right.
Even if the dollar falls sharply, we won't benefit much, because what are we going to export? We don't have any TVs to export, or VCRs or cameras. So that really will not help our country in any way. So the depression, because that could have prevented the depression. If we had a good manufacturing base here and the dollar falls sharply, then we can export a lot. But we won't be able to do that.
Right, but our trade policy has gone nuts. So does that mean that things like gold and oil, which are internationally traded, and their price really tends to, at least denominated in dollars, tends to reflect the value of the dollar more than it does necessarily the scarcity of gold or oil, would be reasonable investments as opposed to, for example, buying stock in the Dow?
Yeah, I think gold is going to go up, because I think inflation will pick up some more. Will heat up in the second half of this decade, so gold will be a good place to go to. And stock markets are going to move sideways because profits are certainly rising. Wages still are stagnant and productivity is high. So mm-hmm. profits will be rising, but then on the same side you have rising price of oil and the housing bubble. Plus, you know, you were talking about this what's happening in the Middle East, all those protests and other. So they will keep the economy uncertain. So stocks will move sideways, either going up, not going down for a while. So the better investments will be gold and maybe even commodities like oil.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I have a friend who has invested quite a bit of money in Canadian oil companies, and he said that not only does he get the benefit of the increase in the value of oil, because Canada apparently is the first or second largest supplier of oil to the United States, but also the Canadian dollar goes up relative to the U.S. dollar as our dollar deflates.
Yeah,
and he's just about doubled his money in the last 2 years.
That's right. If you are in the U.S., then investing in Canada will be pretty good, yes.
Now, the other question I had for you, Dr. Ravi Batra, is Ben Bernanke is taking the place of Alan Greenspan. What's your opinion of this guy?
See, he at least knows some economics. Greenspan did not know any economics, and I have shown that again, again and again.
Did Greenspan have a degree in economics?
He did not have a PhD in economics.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So how did he get the job?
Well, if you throw good parties and call in the Republican bigwigs, then they got him the job.
Amazing. So Greenspan didn't even have a PhD in economics, but Ben Bernanke does.
Yeah, he's of course, he's excellent economic credentials, but I don't think he also has an anti-labor attitude. He doesn't even know. He has written a textbook with another author, and in the textbook, they don't even know if the real wages have been falling for the vast majority of American workers. They don't even mention that. And that's a textbook on macroeconomics, which is very strange to me.
So we've got another ivory tower multimillionaire conservative who doesn't understand that the economy really has so much to do with how the average person is doing.
That's right. And I think we need to cut the trade deficit sharply. By the way, I have a plan for it in Greenspan's fraud, a very simple plan. Maybe if you have time sometime, we should talk about how we can eliminate the trade deficit in the country without giving up on free trade, and I think that will do a lot to improve our economy.
Well, my suggestion is just go back to tariffs.
I know, but tariffs in the short term will cause chaos, and they will get the blame.
Right.
That's why I
but
like
they, but it did work for 230 years.
Oh, yeah. In the long run, it should work out nicely.
We'll have to have you back to talk about that, because I know you've got some significant thoughts on that. Ravi Batra, RAVIBATRA.com, his website, his book, Greenspan's Fraud. And Ravi Batra, thanks for coming back and helping us wrap this up. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour. You're in the real free speech zone.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by revitalizing democracy in the United States of America. The first, I guess, full week here of the new Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke. And it's interesting, if you look at the history, the last three times that the Fed has changed chairmans, within 2 or 3 months of the new chairman coming in, there has been a crisis, an economic crisis in the United States. And I'm certainly of the opinion, I share Ravi Batra's perspective, I actually learned much of it from him, from reading his book, Greenspan's Fraud, that Alan Greenspan has set us up for a disaster. And I'll tell you, one of the people who has been warning us about this for a long, long, long time is Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has been taking on his old nemesis, Alan Greenspan, for forever. And so in this final kind of memorial to Alan Greenspan, since this is the tail end of the orgy of memorials to him now that he's gone, at least from the economic scene, his wife, Andrea Mitchell, of course, still very active in the media, and I'm sure Alan Greenspan will still be very active in conservative circles. Just a little clip, Bernie Sanders taking on Alan Greenspan.
Mr. Greenspan, I have long been concerned that you are way out of touch with the needs of the middle class and working families of our country, that you see your major function in your position as the need to represent the wealthy and large corporations. And I must tell you that your testimony today only confirms all of my suspicions. And I urge you, and I mean this seriously, because you're an honest person. I think you just don't know what's going on in the real world. And I would urge you, come with me to Vermont. Meet real people. the country clubs and the cocktail parties are not real America. The millionaires and billionaires are the exception to the rule.
And in fact, Bernie talking to Alan Greenspan about this now, according to Ravi Batra, Ben Bernanke, the author of a book in which he never discusses the average working person and their impact on the economy. And the fact of the matter is that most of the economy, and this is something that Franklin Roosevelt understood so well, most of the economy is the economy by virtue of the fact that average working people are getting a paycheck and spending it out there in the real world. So anyhow, Bernie continues.
You talk about an improving economy while we have lost 3 million private sector jobs in the last 2 years. Long-term unemployment has more than tripled. Unemployment is higher than it has been since 1994. We have a $4 trillion national debt. 1.4 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Millions of seniors can't afford prescription drugs. Middle-class families can't send their kids to college because they don't have the money to do that. Bankruptcy cases have increased by a record-breaking 23%. Business investment is at its lowest level in more than 50 years. CEOs make more than 500 times of what their workers make. The middle class is shrinking. We have the greatest gap between the rich and the poor of any industrialized nation, and this is an economy that is improving. I hate to see what would happen if our economy was sinking.
This is just the beginning of Bernie Sanders taking on Alan Greenspan, and it'll be interesting to see how he takes on Ben Bernanke, same thing. And at the same time, by the way, in today's paper, for example, today's Wall Street Journal article by Brody Mullins, move to extend lower tax rates on capital gains and dividends stalls. Yeah, George W. Bush, one of his most recent tax cuts, this was a year before last, as I recall, reduced the tax on capital gains and on dividends. In other words, if you own stock and that company shows a profit and they distribute that profit to their stockholders, or if you own a company and the company is profitable, then you only pay a maximum 15% income tax. You're not like the rest of us. You're not like the rest of us. You only pay a maximum 15% income tax. This is a tax system, a tax, what would you call it? A unique category of taxpayer that Alan Greenspan totally supported. And this thing is going to expire in the next couple of years, and the Republicans are dancing as fast as they can to get it renewed. And oddly enough, there are a few Republicans who are standing up on their hind legs and saying, no, we're not going to go along with that. Back to Bernie Sanders.
Now, today, you may not have known this. I suspect that you don't. But you have insulted tens of millions of American workers. You have defended over the years, among other things, the abolition of the minimum wage, one of your policies, and giving huge tax breaks to billionaires. But today you reached a new low, I think, by suggesting that manufacturing in America doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where the product is produced. We lost 2 million manufacturing jobs in the last 2 years alone, 10% of our workforce. Walmart has replaced General Motors as the major employer in America, paying people starvation wages rather than living wages, and all of that does not matter to you. Doesn't matter if it's produced in China, where workers are making 30 cents an hour, or produced in Vermont, where workers can make 20 bucks an hour. It doesn't matter. You have told the American people that you support a trade policy which is selling them out, only working for the CEOs who can take our plants to China, Mexico, and India. You insulted Mr. Castle. Mr. Castle, a few moments ago, a good Republican, told you that we're seeing not only the decline of manufacturing jobs, but white-collar information technology jobs. Forrester Research says that over the next 15 years, 3.3 million U.S. service industry jobs and $136 billion in wages will move offshore to India, Russia, China, and the Philippines. Does any of this matter to you? Do you give one whit of concern to the middle class and working families of this country? That's my question.
Yeah, now we'll hear from Mr. Greenspan.
Congressman, we have the highest standard of living in the world.
No, we do not. You go to Scandinavia and you will find that people have a much higher standard of living in terms of education, health care, and decent paying jobs. Wrong, Mr. Greenspan.
May I answer your question?
You sure may.
Thank you. For a major industrial country, we have created the most advanced technologies, the highest standard of living for a country of our size.
Now, keep in mind, we're the only country of our size. Germany and Japan, 50 million people in Germany, 40, I don't recall the populations of Germany, but it's not the 300 million of the United States. So that's like, sort of like saying, if you only consider yellow cars, then we've got nothing but yellow cars in the United States. It's just very strange.
Our economic growth is crucial to us. The incomes, the purchasing power of our employees, our workers, our people, are by far more important than what it is we produce. I submit to you that, may I? the major focus of monetary policy is to create an environment in this country which enables capital investment and innovation to advance. We are at the cutting edge of technologies in the world. We are doing an extraordinary job over the years, and people flock to the United States. Our immigration rates are very high, and why? Because they think this is a wonderful country to come
to. That is an incredible answer.
Yeah. Mr. Paul?
A tragically incredible answer. Bernie Sanders taking on Alan Greenspan. This is from, 2-3 years ago, actually. It's an older clip. But it's still vital. I mean, it's still here. And ongoing. By the way, Japan, 127 million people. Germany, 80-some-odd million people. And the United States, of course, in the neighborhood of 300 million people. So when Greenspan says, we have the strongest economy for a nation of our size, of course, there's no other nation of our size that is fully industrialized. tragic. Alfonso Sosa, a house painter. This is from the Austin American Statesman from Austin, Texas. A house painter in Austin, Texas, who made about $20,000 last year, filed for bankruptcy. This is from an article by Robert Elder in the American Statesman. Filed for bankruptcy the morning of December 6th, hoping to avoid the foreclosure on his family's mobile home scheduled for later that day. Judge Frank Monroe of Austin rejected the case 16 days later with a bang. In his ruling, Monroe said the new federal bankruptcy law is full of traps for consumers, calling some of its provisions inane, absurd, and incomprehensible to any rational human being. This is the new bankruptcy law. You might want to call your member of Congress or your senator and ask them if they voted for this. I'm all the words that come to mind are words you can't see on the radio. This piece of legislation. He stopped just short, writes Robert Elder, talking of this judge, this bankruptcy judge. He stopped just short of accusing Congress of being bought and paid for, dryly noting, quote, apparently it is not the individual consumers of this country who make the donations to the members of Congress that allow them to be elected and reelected and reelected and reelected. We are now seeing, my friends, the results of a bought and paid for Congress, whether it's Tom DeLay or whether it's John Boehner or whether whoever it may be. Ordinarily, back to the story from the Austin, the American Statesman, ordinarily a case such as the Sosa's, which primarily concerns a mobile home and land valued at $32,000, would quietly disappear in a court archives. But Monroe's order has caught fire in the world of bankruptcy and consumer law. It's been debated on law blogs and circulated across the country. It's, popping all over the place. Monroe, by the way, is not the first judge to get, as the article says, to tee off on the new bankruptcy law, which was a priority of President Bush and heavily backed by the credit industry. Most bankruptcy lawyers, scholars, and judges remain sore that Congress didn't listen to their warnings about the hardships the law would impose on people. And then they go through a list of all these different judges and what they're saying and how this is basically the average guy, the average man and woman in America, screwed by this new bankruptcy bill that is now law. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
When I feel that lonesome prairie wind, I let my soul get back to you.
I
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Also in the Wall Street Journal today, Toyota Motor Corporation, which reported a 34% jump in fiscal third quarter net income, is pouring a record amount of money into new factories. Guess where? Here! Isn't it interesting? GM and Ford crashing, Toyota building factories in the United States. They're expecting a 10% growth in the U.S. this year. 17 million vehicles. Overall growth, new car sales in the U.S. They're expecting 10% growth. A lot of that's going to be imports. Toyota's exports to North America rose 16%. That's from Japan to the United States to 940,000 cars during 2005. And Toyota officials say privately that exports could rise well above 1 million annual vehicles in the years ahead. Yeah, right. The bottom line here is our trade policies are so insane that when these companies end up with all this money, all this American cash, because they can make a car cheaper than we can because they don't have to pay health care costs in Japan, so they can put that extra money into you know, a spiffy interior, a little extra tooling or engineering, and manufacture these cars in Japan, ship them into the United States. Then they're sitting on all these dollars. What do they do with the dollars? Well, they have to spend them in the United States, so they're buying America. How do they buy America? Well, they come over here and they build factories and they make cars for us. It is the selling out of our country, the hollowing out of our industrial infrastructure. Japan now owns our industrial infrastructure. And you think you can buy stock in Toyota? No, I'm sorry, you can't. You're not Japanese. What you can buy is you can buy what's called an ADR, an American deposit receipt. You can buy a share of somebody in Japan who owns stock in Toyota, for example. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Hey, Tom. About a couple of months ago, there were some hearings where Greenspan was present, and I don't know exactly what it pertained to, but it was the Economic Committee that was present, and I can't remember. She was a representative from California. She had asked Greenspan. He keeps mentioning, and you mentioned this earlier with Ravi Batra, that Greenspan keeps insisting that if you move towards a service economy, you know, where we have our manufacturing leaving our country and we're having more and more so service economy, that we're going to have the highest standards of living in the world. My first question to you, Tom, is I don't agree with it. Is there an example of that or somewhere around the world where another country is exclusively service industry and they have a high standard of living? And my second question is, I personally feel Americans are under the illusion that it's just manufacturing. There are jobs like human resources, payroll. The mortgage industry is starting to do that, and not so much like loan officers, but more so like the paperwork that's done behind the scenes.
Right, it's all moving to India.
Yeah, and so I think we're under this illusion that it's just, you know, it's not going to be my job. But I'm seeing more and more, you know, the IT jobs like you mentioned.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate more on that also?
Well, it's very simple, Patricia. There is the whole idea that a service-based industry is an industry that can support a nation is a fantasy. There is no nation in the history of the world that has ever supported itself as a service-based industry. And when a nation lacks the ability to manufacture the goods that it itself uses, it has made itself absolutely and totally vulnerable to other predatory nations. And if you look back at the history of the world, you look back at nations that end up being invaded by other nations, they have no industrial infrastructure. And this is the selling out of America. I mean, if you wanted to create a Manchurian candidate kind of story where you get a president and a Fed chairman, or a series of presidents, actually, the last four presidents and a Fed chairman in running the country whose job was to destroy the country so that it had no industrial infrastructure left whatsoever, so that there was no middle class left whatsoever, so it was ripe for the takeover by entity out there. You know, the old boogeyman used to be the Soviet Union. I'd say multinational corporations. You've got it right here. And the multinational corporations have taken over with the WTO. In fact, just yesterday, another one of the articles I've got in my stack that I was going to get to, is the WTO has said to Europe now, you've got to take genetically modified foods grown in the United States. You can't not do it because it's against the rules. We are in charge now. Individual nations are not in charge anymore. Patricia, thanks for the call. I got to move along. I appreciate it. Well said. Dan in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Yeah. Hi, Tom Hartman?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was I the only one watching K2 at about 1:05 to 1:07 p.m. Sunday? Right at the mix or conversion of digital sports that they do as they go into the pre-show and the announcers, they have like a baseball, football, and all these athletes converging on one another. they stuck surreptitiously, and it was so bizarre. Bill Clinton saying, I did not have sex with that woman.
Yeah, somebody called yesterday about that also. I didn't see the game because I was flying home from London on the day. But
That is obviously something pathetic and sick about that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, Dan.
So that we can get a copy of it. I mean, it was comical.
It was a montage of other historical quotes, but that particular quote got played twice, and it seems like it's over the top to me. I agree with you, Dan. Bill in Long Island. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, I wanted to share something with you and Bernie on Friday, but I think it fits now today.
Sure.
What a lot of companies have been doing for several years, because my brother was part of this, what they do is they turn around and they take their full-time employees and put them as a part-time employee. But what they do is they give them a rotating shift each week, so you can't even go out and get a second part-time job now.
Oh, my.
And now I was talking with someone at Sears, and they were telling me the same thing is happening over there with the Sears holding after the merger. People are being told that, yes, you can get a different job, but it's going to be part-time, and the hours rotate. So if you want to go out and get another job, too bad. So, I mean, they're really pushing.
Now, are they doing this as a way of keeping employees, in other words, preventing them from getting other jobs, that they, you know, to reduce losses? I don't get why they would do this.
I don't know, but all I know is it's really pushing us to the bottom at an even faster rate the more they do things like
that. Oh, yeah. Oh, the war on the middle class is real, Bill. I mean, there's no, it's not a undeclared war. I'm sorry. There's a real war on the middle class being led by conservatives in this country. Ronald Reagan kicked it off when he busted up PATCO and just came right out and basically, for all practical purposes, said that, you know, the conservatives were declaring war on the middle class in America. And sure enough, here we are. We have the economy that they brought us and $8 trillion in debt to go along with it that our children and grandchildren are going to have to pay. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman on the True People's Radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman Radio Program for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief at frameshopisopen.com. Be sure to put in the is open part. Frameshopisopen.com. Otherwise, you get a little strange sex site, which might be appropriate for Valentine's Day coming up, I suppose. But that might be a stretch. Anyhow, frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey Feldman, one of the great experts on neurolinguistic programming and framing and just the whole idea of the use of language that's going on. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
The New York Times, February 8th, article, some Democrats are sensing missed opportunities. Democrats sitting around wringing their hands that they didn't go after the Republicans the way that the Republicans would have gone after them. What's up?
The Democrats are just really, really concerned, I think, that that people look at looking at the current political situation and seeing two parties bickering. The Democrats are afraid. They're afraid to get labeled as just politics as usual. And not offering any good ideas. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, unfortunate is an understatement, shall we say, Jeffrey Feldman. What is the frame that the Democrats should be using?
Well, I think that the key issue right now on this domestic spy scandal that's unfolding, there really are two issues, both in terms of what the Democrats need to be saying and how they need to be saying it. Early on when this scandal broke, I felt that the Democrats were being way too polite. The Republicans were standing up and saying that this spy program was protecting America from destruction, and the Democrats were responding saying that there were technicalities in the law that were coming under duress. So at first, I felt that the Democrats needed to steal the scene. They needed to take a page from Cindy Sheehan's playbook and demand to meet with the president and be a lot more forceful than they were being. The second thing they needed to do is...
Now, wait a minute. Demand to meet with the president. You mean the Democrats should have, like, camped out in front of the White House and said, you know, until you explain to us what's going on, we're not going away?
A media event, absolutely. They need to go beyond these conventional ways of interacting with the Republicans. They are constantly being circled by Republicans. Every time during the Gonzales hearings, for example, or even during the Alito hearings, that the Democrats said something that was vaguely challenging, the Republicans would respond and bracket it, and by the end of the exchange, it was as if the Democrats said nothing. They need to take advantage of every tool that they have at their disposal, and if that means standing in front of the White House, calling a press conference, then that's what they need to do.
Yeah, way too many harumps. It's time to call this. And the other thing that was amazing, I mean, you know, Bush says, oh, we've got to have these illegal wiretaps to protect Americans. Well, listen, what I don't get is why the Democrats haven't said, we would like you to protect Americans by being able to throw terrorists in jail. And if you get this information illegally, you can't use it in a court of law.
Exactly. I mean, what's fascinating, Dick Cheney had a long interview last night with Jim Lehrer on the NewsHour, and it was really interesting to see what the strategy for framing this issue was coming directly out of Cheney. What the Republicans are claiming is that violating the secrecy of this act itself endangers America, as if national security was dependent entirely on whether or not we keep this one program a secret. If that's what our national security depends on, we're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, that interview really troubled me. I mean, it's increasingly becoming national Republican broadcasting now that the Republicans have stacked the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with Republican toadies.
Exactly.
But we digress.
We do digress. But Jim Lehrer had the vice president in his hands when he was trying to get him to talk about the balance between secrecy and accountability. And he said, is it more important that this program remain secret than anything else? But Lehrer should have pushed him on that, because it seems that the phrase that we need to start using is secret police to describe what's going on in this program. We have an administration which is claiming that everything with regards to national security depends on the president having absolute authority over this mysterious force that is listening in on phone calls. And that, I believe, is the frame that we need to push.
Secret police. That's a great one. You know, Section 503 or 603 of the, or 605 or whatever it is, of the new Patriot Act that the Republicans are proposing contains a provision which would expand the SS, the Secret Service, from being a presidential protection detail to being a national police force under the direct control and protection of the president, and give the SS the authority to go into any community where there is any public event and declare that public event an event of national significance, and then be able to essentially federalize it, override and overrule the objections of local or state authorities, and arrest people, carry weapons, and arrest people without a warrant. And this is in the new Patriot Act, and I'm just amazed that there aren't more Democrats out there yelling and screaming about it. I'm hearing, frankly, most of the complaints about it coming from Republicans, people like Lou Dobbs and Ron Paul, the Republican from Texas.
Well, we've got complaints coming from Democrats. The other day here in New York, I heard Russ Feingold give a talk, and it was a great speech about how these policies were violating the Constitution, both in terms of how they were being pushed through the Congress and what was in them. But afterwards, when I approached him and I asked him what was the one phrase we should be repeating about why these were so problematic, all he could say to me was that, you know, library records. Do you want the government checking your library records? And unfortunately, I just think the Democrats are looking too small when they're protesting against these policies. They really need to talk about what is startling and frightening about these programs. They need to talk about the Secret Service cracking down on ordinary Americans without warrants. They need to bring what is really horrific about these programs to people's attention and do it loudly.
Oh, the FBI snooping on Granny. I mean, literally, a group of grandmothers at a Quaker meeting.
Exactly. I mean, it's
outrageous.
It is outrageous. And with the Democrats, they keep on repeating this word wiretapping, which is appropriate on some level. But wiretapping brings to mind this idea of somebody sitting in a truck and listening in on a phone call, and that's not entirely accurate. What the administration is doing is trolling for information. They are running algorithms and collecting literally warehouses full of information and then trying to figure out what to do about this.
Yeah.
Just about every American is involved with this particular type of search, and the Democrats need to hit on that.
Right, and not only are they trolling for information, but they're bringing private corporations in on the act, which means that information is no longer protected under some of the few badly shredded but remaining privacy protections we have under federal law. It's incredible. We're talking to Jeffrey Feldman. Frameshopisopen.com is website. One of the great framers in America. Jeffrey Feldman, what do you see as the main frame coming out of the Republican Party here? What should we be looking for?
the cartoon controversy coming out of the Middle East. We had some cartoons that were offensive to Islam published in European countries, in Denmark and in France, that has sparked a series of very violent riots all throughout the Middle East. And the Republican Party is, again, believe it or not, going to try to spin this as evidence of the importance of continuing to spread freedom in the Middle East. Remarkably, we're going to hear this out of the White House. And Democrats need to respond with the phrase, fueling the fire. American presence in the Middle East is not spreading anything even close to democracy, but it is fueling the fire that's giving rise to even more radical regimes.
Isn't that mixing up two issues, though? I mean, the cartoons really are an issue of free speech, and the fueling the fire is our being in Iraq.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, though, that the broader picture is the question of how the Bush administration is going to try to play this to...
In other words, these cartoons might never have caused this revolt if there wasn't already an underlying paranoia among Muslims around the world that the United States or that the Western power was, that the Christian powers that and Israel as well, I guess the Christian and Jewish powers, are declaring war on Islam in their minds because of our war in Iraq.
Exactly. I mean, you've got pressure building up and people are responding in this way.
Now, I just got an email from one of the right-wing promo sites, you know, one of the right-wing groups that, well-funded right-wing groups that tries to get guests on talk shows. And they're talking about how Katrina victims now, 5,000 Katrina victims, are going to be kicked out of their hotels at the end of the month. And this email said, and the left wing is spinning it that these people are the poor victims, but in fact, we've already given over $6 billion worth of aid to the Katrina victims, blah, 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 blah. It seems to me that the Reich is trying to re-spin Katrina now.
Yeah, it is unbelievable.
What's your sense of that, and do you think that they will have success in doing it, Jeffrey Feldman?
I think people have short-term memories, but whether or not they have success will depend on how much the Democrats can get people who are actually in that area to tell their stories in the media again. That was really crucial during Katrina itself, to listen to the people who were victims of the storm and victims of the slow movement of the Republican government to stand up and to make themselves heard.
Well, and now we just had this GAO study that showed that pointed to Michael Chertoff as the cause of the problem. And that was a story that lasted in the media for all of, what, 8 hours?
Exactly. It's unbelievable. I mean, people seem to really agree, for example, with the White House's privilege to keep documents pertaining to Katrina private for some reason, as if that somehow is part of executive privilege.
Well, this is national security. After all, it was a radical Islamic hurricane.
Exactly.
I mean, it had to be, right?
Yes.
There's still 1,000 children missing. There's still somewhere between 3 and 15,000 people missing from New Orleans. We don't know the numbers yet, and the Bush administration wants to keep all this stuff secret, and yet they were sifting through the rubble for the last little bit of DNA from the largely white, largely wealthy folks at the World Trade Center that Bush was exploiting rather than being harmed by. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, the website. Check it out. Jeffrey, thanks so much for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
A song will lift as the mainsail shifts and the boat drifts unto the shoreline. And the sun will respect every face on the deck the hour that the ships come in.
And welcome back to Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. Here we are defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. You, too, can be part of it. Glad to have you with us. We're going to be taking your calls in just a few minutes. 440-8466, our phone number, 866-440-THOM. First of all, Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News is with us, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Greg, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, Tom, I have a story for you.
Okay.
I just spent 2 hours on the west lawn of the U.S. Capitol at what started out to be a Minuteman rally to curb illegal immigration
right.
in the Amnesty Worker Program.
This is the thing that Tom Tancredo was helping pull together?
That's right. And Representative Tancredo showed up about halfway through the rally, and he spoke to about, I'd say, 200 people.
Uh-huh.
And Jim Gilchrist, who founded the Minuteman Project, you know, was also a speaker, and it was a relatively normal rally. And then, about halfway through, right before Tom Tancredo got there, two men dressed as Nazis from the National Socialist, I guess it's called the Nationalist Socialist Movement, America's Nazi Party showed up in brown shirts and armbands.
You mean real Nazis?
Real Nazis. in brown shirts and armbands with a swastika. And they started marching towards the Minuteman podium.
Right.
And everyone in the Minuteman group got very nervous because they're trying to distance themselves from being called Nazis. However, they understand
But here come the real Nazis.
It gets better. The real Nazis were coming. Yeah. As opposed to the alleged Nazis of the Minutemen.
Right.
And then a group of just plain protesters showed up,
uh-huh,
wearing masks, and it's illegal to protest in Washington, D.C. I didn't know this until now. It's illegal to wear a mask while you're protesting in Washington, D.C. And they were wearing ski masks and holding signs that said, why don't you just call yourself the KKK?
Right.
So we had one group protesting the Minutemen itself. We had another group who were the Nazis, who were protesting both the protesters and the Minutemen. Then a group of African-American men showed up to protest the Nazis, who had been moved by the U.S. Capitol Police across the street in front of the Capitol, and they were doing their darndest to try to keep the three groups apart.
Oh,
and
boy.
Everyone is screaming and chanting and yelling, and it became a hey, hey, ho, ho, immigration has got to go versus they're our brothers, they're our sisters, they have a right to stay.
Right.
On and on. I've never seen anything like it. This sort of, you know, it blossomed into a who's on the right side. And then, of course, when Representative Pancreto showed up, it was sort of, you know, he tried to bring a respectable face, you know, to the issue and saying, look, if you live in California, if you live in Arizona, where he's from, if you live on the border.
No, he's from Colorado, actually.
Oh, right. That's right. He's from Colorado. You know, this is a serious problem, and it's not about hate. He said it's not about hate. And if you believe in hate and racism, you don't belong in our group. We just believe that Americans should be paid a fair wage for doing the jobs that are being done now by these illegal immigrants for $5 an hour.
Yeah. You know, I got to say, Greg, I've had Tom Tancredo in this program, and he has a point. The problem is his solution is so Republican. It's so tragic. I mean, there is something really to be said for, you know, the United States shouldn't be the solution to the fact that Mexico is run by an oligarchy, the 36 wealthy families and a corrupt former Coca-Cola executive are running Mexico into the ground, and as a result, 10% of the GDP of Mexico is money being sent home by people who are here in the United States working illegally. And the conservatives know that, you know, so the laws of supply and demand are very real, and if you can increase the supply of labor, then the price of labor drops. And so if you can bring 10 million illegal immigrants into the United States, you're going to wipe out the labor unions, because you're going to make it hard for the labor unions to maintain labor scarcity, which they have to do in order for the threat of a strike to have any power. So, Tancredo is actually right when he says that illegal immigration is hurting America and hurting American labor.
That's exactly what he said today. And
he said
that the Mexican police department is so corrupt that they're not even guarding their own border, therefore we have to do the job on this side.
Right, but see, here's where the solution breaks down. The simple solution to this thing, I mean, Tancredo, I think, is, and a lot of these conservatives who are concerned about illegal immigration in the United States, they're right in what I just laid out, but then they say the solution is to build a wall. And that is nuts. The solution, I mean, there's the reason why you've got 10 or 11 million illegal aliens in the United States is because people will hire them. And if you simply passed a law that said any CEO of any corporation that hires even one illegal alien goes to prison for a minimum of 6 months, suddenly you'd have 10 million people lined up at the Mexican border trying to get back into Mexico. But Tancredo won't do that because the wealthy Republican donors don't want to go along with that one. So.
Well, that's exactly what, like I said, those are the points he made just now today. And, of course, it got a little dicey because he doesn't want to be represented by, you know, any kind of protest or obviously any kind of Nazi party.
But, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you look at this as part of a conservative economic conspiracy to destroy the middle class, the American middle class, which I think it is, then, you know, having stupid solutions like let's build a wall, well, that causes people to think you're doing something about it when you're not. But if you get it, that this is really, you know, that the illegal immigration problem in the United States didn't exist before Ronald Reagan started these kinds of policies of breaking up unions. When we had a very open border for 200 years, we had no problem. And then Reagan comes along and boom, look at what we've got. The solution becomes quite simple. I mean, the unions used to be the ones who kept illegal immigrants out of the workforce. And, you know, Reagan wiped them out. Anyhow, Greg Gorman, thanks a lot for the report. That's a great story. Okay. TalkRadioNews.com, if you want to check it out. TalkRadioNews.com. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com, T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, but actually, any way you spell it should get you there. And just click the live chat link, and it'll drop you in. You can say hi. Glad to have you back with us. And Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I originally called just to make the point about the Republicans' economic policies. Just they really just want to drive down the economic standing of the Democratic constituency,
which is the middle class.
Yeah, but yeah. Actually, I wanted to talk about wiretapping at this hearing.
Sure.
It seemed like the questioners were asleep at the wheel in terms of Gonzalez's argument, which seemed to be that there is a stipulation in FISA that allows for a statute to come along and override it. And that statute was the War Powers Act. And they never really, like, addressed that argument. And I always kept accusing the president of willingly breaking the law. And they're making the claim that they aren't breaking the law. So it just seemed to be kind of like a runaround.
Yeah, it becomes a he said, she said.
Yeah, and when Feinstein was on that fine point, she said, I don't see it in the language. And then she's like, let's move on. I mean, it's just like, why are you moving on?
Well, because ultimately this is going to be resolved by one of two means. It's either going to be resolved by impeachment, and that's going to happen if the Democrats take the House back, and or if they take back the Senate. They're going to have the House, though, to tender articles of impeachment. So if they only take the Senate, that's not going to be enough. They're going to have to take the House and the Senate, number one. Or, number two, it's going to end up before the Supreme Court, in which case Alito and Roberts, I think we can predict their guesses,
right,
or their votes.
The main question is if it's a limited program, why should we believe you that it's a limited program? That's
right.
They never asked that.
Oh, that's the whole... I mean, this is where, Logan, where you and I and every other progressive in this country are startlingly on the exact same page with the traditional classic Barry Goldwater conservatives saying, hey, wait a minute, we think that there should be limits on the power of government. And,
exactly.
You know, that is not a conservative or liberal position. I know that the conservatives for many, many years staked it out as their position. But, I mean, it was Thomas Jefferson's position from the get-go, and he founded the Democratic Party. He was the first person, well, actually, George Washington was the first American politician to call himself a liberal and say that he was proud of it. But, you know, this is trans-political. And the unrestrained power of government is, by definition, government with unrestrained power is tyranny. And that's what we have to worry about here, and that's and hopefully more and more Democrats will be speaking up and speaking out about it. I appreciate the call, Logan.
Yeah,
good to hear from
thanks,
you. Thank you. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Just a quick question. How, if presuming a regaining of a progressive liberal majority in either the House, Senate, or both, how do we extract our country from structures like the WTO and GATT? And NAFTA and CAFTA.
Right. Well, two issues you raised, Jerry. One is a progressive or liberal majority in the House or Senate is going to take more than simply a Democratic majority because the Democratic Party has been infiltrated by people from the Reich and the Democratic Leadership Council and company. In fact, there's an interview I did with BuzzFlash over on their website at BuzzFlash.com today that talks about this. But directly to your question, the answer is very simple. When George W. Bush came into office... And by the way, he taught us this. When he came into office, we had agreed to the Kyoto Accords, and we had signed the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty with the Soviet Union and a number of other countries as well. And George W. Bush came into office and said, we're unsigning the agreements. We don't need no stinking treaties. We're simply going to walk away from them. He, as president, without an act of Congress, which is what it takes to pass a treaty, he, as president, simply said, we are no longer a signatory to those treaties. I am unsigning the president's signature that's necessary for a treaty to go into effect. So if we had a progressive president. We had progressive, if we had, see, I don't even think it's progressive. I think it's the old-fashioned, even the old-fashioned conservative notion of, you know, the reason why conservatives used to be hysterical and paranoid about the United Nations, why they are to this day, is they say that, you know, by signing treaties, the Constitution says that if we sign a treaty, that treaty supersedes the law of the land. So if we sign a treaty with, for example, Canada, that says anytime anybody eats maple syrup, drinks, you know, has maple syrup on their pancakes in a pancake house, they have to stand up and sing the Canadian national anthem. Then all over America, once we signed that treaty, anybody who went into an international house of pancakes and had pancakes with syrup and didn't sing the Canadian national anthem could be put in prison, even though no law had been passed in the United States, simply because we'd signed the treaty. So the traditional argument against the United Nations has been that by signing the treaties that make up our membership in the United Nations, the agreements that allow us to participate with the UN, that we have surrendered some of our sovereignty. And there's some truth to that. Although the reason we do that is because we do it to achieve world peace, to live in a world of peace. The whole purpose of the UN is to prevent war. Now, if you want a real surrender of sovereignty, look at the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, CAFTA, the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, the upcoming General Agreement on Tariffs and Services, the intellectual property tariffs. I mean, all these things, these are laws that we've signed that completely do away with many of our domestic laws and turn them over not to foreign governments, not to a body of elected government, not to an elected body of governments like the United Nations. And yes, there are some bad actors in the United Nations, but nonetheless, it's a collective body and people vote there. Instead of turning it over to them, we're turning it over to a group of multinational corporations.
Yeah.
So the simple answer to your question is we simply say, the president would simply say, we're no longer a member of the World Trade Organization. Sorry. End of discussion. We're unsigning CAFTA, we're unsigning NAFTA. It could be done, Jerry, in 24 hours. That's all.
Irony sweet. Bush might be responsible for kicking the pins out of their core agenda.
It really is, and tragic too that it has taken such a toll on America that so many Americans have had their lives destroyed, their livelihoods destroyed, their savings destroyed because of these conservative economic policies the last 25 years. That's what it's taking to wake up America. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Chris in Austin, Texas, on the line. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, you're a pretty smart guy. I had a question. I live here in Texas, and we have the problem. We have a lot of out-of-state money influence our local politics.
Yeah, you're not unique in that, by the way.
What's that?
You're not unique in that. We've got local ballot things going on here in Portland, Oregon, where we've got money coming in from Washington, D.C., from think tanks in Wyoming. I mean,
right.
I know it's...
Yeah. Yeah.
It's happening all
over. But I wouldn't argue the money that came through Texas is what's destroyed the country. But anyway... Has anyone ever challenged the constitutionality of out-of-district contributions to a federal race?
In other words, if
we have a two-person district,
right,
and someone from outside of the district donates to a politician in our district, have they not diluted our district?
Interesting. You mean on the basis of the 14th Amendment?
Right.
Yeah, I don't think so, because that person is not claiming a right to vote, which is really what the 14th Amendment talks about when it reset how congressional districts are established. The argument that could be made is that a district should have the right to say that, for example, a corporation can't contribute money to political causes. And that got struck down by the Supreme Court in the Boston versus Bilotti case in, as I recall, 1978. And that case is a really interesting one because Massachusetts had a law in the books that said that a corporation can only involve itself in politics if it directly involves the corporation. In other words, if there was going to be a regulation about banking on the ballot, the banks had the right to run political ads and state their point of view. Yeah, which makes a certain amount of sense. I still don't agree with it, but it makes a certain amount of sense.
Right.
And so there was this bank, the First National Bank of Boston, that decided that they were going to throw their political weight behind a political candidate who had nothing to do with banking and a campaign that had nothing to do with banking. They were going to defy the law. Frank Bilotti, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, decided to bust them for it. They did so. You don't arrest a bank, but he charged them with a crime. And they took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, very closely decided, voted that a corporation is a person under the law. And because it's a person, then they have the right to free speech. Because it doesn't have a mouth, the form of speech has to be money, and therefore the bank was justified in giving money to politicians, and that kicked open the door. That decision, that was one of three big Supreme Court decisions that basically made campaign finance reform so difficult. That's why McCain-Feingold has to regulate politicians instead of corporations.
Well, and that's actually what I was thinking about, because if they're going to equate my vote to my political influence and say something deserves political influence that doesn't have a vote, then aren't they, in fact, diluting my constitutional right to vote?
They are. And I would strongly make that case along with you, Chris. And in fact, I wrote an entire book about this called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And what's incredibly ironic is in the Boston versus Bilotti case, the lead dissent was written by William Rehnquist. He was opposed to that decision. And as a actual true conservative, Rehnquist came out and said, it's wrong that corporations be considered persons. They're not persons. And they shouldn't be a protected class just like persons. But he was in the minority. And I'm telling you, Judge John Roberts and Sam Alito are on the record over and over and over again, as is virtually the entire Federalist Society, as saying that corporations should have the rights of persons. And more so than that, they can live forever. They can accumulate wealth forever. They never have to go through probate. They don't have to worry about getting sick. They don't have to worry about the air being dirty or carcinogenic or the water being poisoned, it's et cetera, et cetera. Yet, and they can't vote, yet they should have political rights. It's incredible. Thanks a lot for the call and giving me an opportunity to rant about that. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here in the middle of the vast medical, radical middle conspiracy.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Standing here on a highway, turned into a lake. Born on this planet that I didn't make. The ice caps are melting, you can measure the rise of the poisoned oceans. Hear all the lies of the political pundits and corporate crooks, their accountants and scientists cooking the books with hardly an inkling of what it's about. Wedded to profit and flooding and drowned. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Place where we run rings around the right wing every single day. Welcome to the program, Elaine in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Elaine.
Hi, Tom. I have a question first, and then I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Do we, the people, have the right to be able to get a hold of the Patriot Act in writing and Homeland Security laws?
Yes. Yeah, as a matter of fact, the existing Patriot Act you can find with a little bit of Googling without much of a problem, and Find Law is the resource, findlaw.com is the resource I usually use, and the proposed Patriot Act is also out there. It's on several congressional websites, and in fact, I wrote an article a week or two ago for Common Dreams. If you go to tomhartman.com and click Articles on Democracy, I think it's the second one down from the top, and it has embedded into it a link to the text for the proposed new changes for the Patriot Act.
Well, I'm concerned because we had a court case. I didn't. A friend had a relative, young relative, that was in court the other day here, Superior Court. He had been arrested for fighting with another kid. They took him to court the second time, Superior Court, and gave him a $100 fine for this and a $100 fine for that. And then they released him on lifetime probation.
Whoa.
I have never heard of that. And you know, it made the hackles on my neck stand up because of the fact that I have read somewhere in the past about them rounding up young people in order to get them into the Army. They give them a choice or else, you know?
Yeah. Well, that was a very common thing, actually, during the Vietnam War.
Well, it's... Is this the lifetime probation they're going to give these people?
You know, I don't know. The only lifetime probations that I've heard of are either for people who commit murder or for sex offenders. But
this was a fight between two kids.
Huh. That's a new one on me, Elaine. And not knowing the case, I don't know. And whether it had anything to do with the Patriot Act, I don't know. But
well, there has to be a change in the laws because normally I have never known. I've spent a lot of time in court as support system with people, but I have never ever come across this before.
Yeah, it does sound very strange and. But I, you know, I just not knowing the details of it, I can't comment on it. But I appreciate your calling and sharing it with us. And if you find out anything more about it, let us know. Billy in Santa Cruz, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Billy, welcome to the program.
I enjoyed the chat in the beginning of the show about Greenspan and the Reagan tax cuts, and I wanted to respond and ask you about my theory and whether you think it's right.
Sure.
Three effects of the Reagan tax cuts that I see. The first one is. For the corporate executives, when they got their taxes lowered that much, it made sense possibly to take a chance on committing fraud, which destroys a lot of our faith and our abilities.
Yep.
The second one is the pension fund not being funded. When these guys could keep so much of their money, then it paid them to cheat their employees and not put the money into the pension so that they could keep their bonuses very high.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is a little complicated. See what you think here. You know, when it's why the Republicans came to destroy government. You know, in government, if you run a part of government, you can't get paid $100 million to do it. And the people that work for you have to get paid a decent wage. If you do the same thing privately, you can underpay your employees, whether they're not government employees, and you can overpay the executive and management staffs at the highest level. You see what I mean?
Sure. Thus, the outsourcing of, you know, we've got somewhere between 20 and 40,000 private contractors in Iraq right now, and all the corporations associated with them. The outsourcing of the war, even.
Am I right that government employees have to sort of get paid a fair wage?
Yeah, and in the civil service law, I believe, if not law, it's certainly been policy pretty much forever. It used to be 20-1. It might have changed in the 8 or 10 years since I last knew the statistics. But it used to be that in civil service, which is, you know, all the government jobs, and also in most universities, that the lowest paid employee could not make less than 1/20th what the most highly paid employee, or to flip it around, the most highly paid employee can't make more than 20 times the bottom employee. And I think that that's also the case still in the military.
And yet in corporate, we've seen it go from around 50 times when...
Right. The average in the 1940s was around 30-1. In the 50s, it was 50-1. And then it stayed there pretty much until the 80s, where it started creeping up. By the 90s, it was around 150-1.
And now it's 480.
Well, it's over 500-1, depending on the industries that you're looking at and whose measurement you're looking at. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you had, you know, Reagan's tax cuts, you know, created this monstrous $200 billion deficit, 75% higher than 1980, the year before. This is the 81 tax cut. And what happened? Unemployment jumped to 10%. 30-year mortgages skyrocketed to 15%. The economy went into a standstill. We had the worst recession since the 1930s. And the way that Reagan got out of it, as Robbie Batra pointed out, was by borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund. Creating it in the first place, doubling our Social Security taxes on people who make, you know, $60,000 a year or less, and then after they're doubling their taxes, taking all that money and spending it, you know, to keep government functioning. It's an absolute crime. Billy, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. And it's mind-boggling. And you almost, you know, at a certain level, you look at this and you almost have to say, you know, are these guys like true believers in a fictitious economic religion, or are they trying to destroy this country? Because that's what they're doing. They're destroying the possibility of democracy in the United States. Could it be that their belief in aristocracy, that you can't trust the masses, is so great and so strong that they're willing to destroy the greatest nation this world has ever seen? I think so. It certainly appears that way. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Over at Information Clearinghouse, Mike Whitney wrote an interesting piece. Bush's tyranny for the bankrupt nation. Welcome back to the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. President Bush has consistently defended his massive $500 billion tax cuts, writes Mike. He's insisted that the deficit spending be a permanent part of the national budget. Central banks around the world getting nervous. Federal debt up a whopping $3 trillion under Bush, more to come. He makes the point that deficits are simply theft. Simply theft. Dick Cheney recently said, well, actually it wasn't recently, it was about 4 years ago, he said, Reagan proved the deficits don't mean anything. In fact, as Mike Whitney points out, Cheney was part of the Reagan administration when Reagan's tax cuts created $200 billion in deficits, up 75% from the year before. Reagan really believed if he cut taxes that it would help the economy. I mean, you know, he drank the Kool-Aid. I just don't know how to say it beyond that. He really and truly believed it. You know, he went out and said, well, you know, maybe if we just reduce these taxes, then folks will take all that extra money that they would have paid in taxes, and they'll simply build factories. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And, well, yeah, it would be wonderful, except that it ain't the case. I mean, it's not what's going to happen. There is some truth to it. They did build factories in China, in Malaysia. I mean, all of the, and the conservatives, they go through this whole song and dance where they say, oh no, well, the reason why we've got to have these tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires is, the proof that we have. See, they can point to no proof in the history of the world of this. And so they say, well, the reason why, the proof is, JFK. The Democrat, JFK. When JFK came into office, the top marginal tax rate was 90%. And you read stories like, I love reading the old Nero Wolfe, Rex Stout novels, you know, these mystery novels. In fact, one of my books of the month last month on BuzzFlash. It was one where Nero Wolfe tweaks J. Edgar Hoover's nose. And it was a marvelous story. For it to have come out when it did in the late 50s, early 60s was unheard of. And Rex Stout, a great patriot, head of the Writers' War Board during World War II in the 1940s, and in those novels, the hero, Rex Stout, this detective who commands enormous fees because he's brilliant, right? Now he talks about how, you know, he works for the first 5 or 6 months of the year, and then he gets, you know, a couple $100,000 in the bank, which in the 1930s and 40s would have been, and 50s would have been equal to, you know, a few $1 million today. And at that point, he pretty much stops working. You know, he doesn't want to work that much more because he only gets 10 cents out of the dollar. And so he engages in creative pursuits, and he eats good meals, and he only takes cases that he really loves and cares about, which is kind of cool. And this was the point that Billy was making a few minutes ago, that, you know, if there is a certain rational limit to the amount that you can accumulate within a certain period of time, then irrational people don't get involved. So Jack Kennedy came along, and he said, you know, I'm part of that class of people who earn mind-boggling amounts of money. And the Kennedy dynasty, they're very wealthy. And he said, and I'm here to tell you that nobody's paying 90% income tax. Certainly none of his friends were. I'm paraphrasing Kennedy now, but he said basically, you know, nobody in my tax bracket is actually paying the 90% because there's all these loopholes. There's thousands of loopholes that have been built in. So what Kennedy proposed to do was actually increase taxes on the rich in America by closing loopholes particularly on business deductions and on dividend deductions. And by closing those loopholes, the loopholes that the rich use to pay lower taxes, and he said we can reduce the top marginal tax rate from 90% to 70%, and we'll actually collect 70%, because right now we're only collecting about 50 or 60% from the very rich because they got all these loopholes. Now, what the cons will tell you is, well, Kennedy dropped taxes from 90% to 70% in 1961, and the next year, government revenues went up. Therefore, Reagan said in 1980, we should drop the top tax rate from 70% down to 30%, and it'll go up even more. That's not what happened, by the way. When Reagan dropped the top marginal tax rate from 70% down to more or less right around 30%, what happened was the government shattered into a million little pieces. We saw a recession that was worse than we had seen since the 1930s. We saw home mortgage rates hitting 15%. We got into what was referred to at the time as the Reagan recession. The cons are going to do their best to try and help you forget that, but Reagan brought us a terrible recession. And Reagan turned to his good friend Alan Greenspan and said, "What am I going to do?" And Greenspan said, double the tax on the average working people because, you know, there's a lot of money there, a lot of people working. I mean, we've had 40 years of Roosevelt economics, of good progressive democratic economics, strong labor unions, you got a strong middle class, you got a lot of factories, you got a lot of people working. If you double the payroll tax on these people, the FICA tax, the tax for Social Security, you're going to create a huge surplus, a trust fund, you can call it, and then you borrow from the trust fund. And Reagan did that. But they did it all in the name of Jack Kennedy, and they continue to. You will still see. In the last 2 weeks, twice, I have seen on national talking head talk shows, I have seen conservatives invoke the name of John Kennedy on behalf of tax cuts. And so let's just listen to what John Kennedy actually had to say about that. This is from the Nixon-Kennedy debates, where Kennedy is saying, and he wraps this thing up by saying, you know, Mr. Nixon keeps distorting my record. Because Nixon kept saying, well, Kennedy wants to just have tax cuts and give away that money, but we got to have a balanced budget. That was Nixon's platform. We got to have a balanced budget. And Kennedy's going to throw this, he's going to ruin the country because he's going to reduce taxes, and that's going to cause the budget to go into deficit. This used to be the Republican position, remember. And that deficit will ruin the country. And Kennedy said, no, I'm actually going to increase taxes. Although we're going to drop the marginal rate, we're going to close the loopholes. So this was Kennedy's rebuttal to Nixon during the debates in 1960.
Yes, I have stated in both the debates, and state again, that I believe in a balanced budget and have supported that concept during my 14 years in the Congress. The only two times when an unbalanced budget is warranted would be during a serious recession, and we had that in 58 in an unbalanced budget of $12 billion, or a national emergency where there should be large expenditures for national defense, which we had in World War II and during part of the Korean War.
Now, get this. The budget deficit in 58-59 during that recession was $12 billion. Bush's deficit this year, if you include the money he's borrowing from Social Security, is going to be close to $600 billion. Anyhow, Kennedy continues.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
And then he elaborates.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education, we'd spend more money on housing, we'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
Here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record. And the conservatives continue to lie about Kennedy. So anyhow, Dick Cheney said, Reagan proved the deficits don't mean anything, and in fact, the opposite is the truth. And what we're really seeing, and Mike Whitney over at Information Clearinghouse points out, is the same kind of shock therapy applied to the United States that the United States applied to other countries. I was in Argentina just shortly after the currency crisis, the collapse there about 5-6 years ago. And the average in Buenos Aires, and the average Argentinian, I mean, people were losing their homes. People were freaked out. And it was because they had borrowed all this money from the IMF, and the IMF said, okay, if you're going to borrow this money, you've got to do away with your social programs or cut them back. You got to privatize certain industry. It's shock therapy. And we're imposing it on countries all over the world. Well, now the conservatives are imposing it on us, turning us into a third world. At the same time that down in South America, Argentina finally paid off the IMF debt last year and said, that's it, you guys. We are no longer your slaves. In Chile, they privatized Social Security. It was a disaster. The bankers made out like bandits. A whole bunch of the banks, the bankers paid themselves multi-million dollar salaries and then declared bankruptcy. They walked off with the salaries of people, with the pensions, the savings of people. Privatization of Social Security, it has happened. It's been tried. And they're walking away from that now. We're seeing in Bolivia and in Venezuela and other countries around South America, in Brazil, we're seeing people saying, enough already. We don't want to surrender our sovereignty to multinational corporations, and we think it's absurd to have tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires and doubling taxes, particularly the payroll taxes, on average working people, and then borrowing that money from that trust fund so that we can give more tax cuts to billionaires and have our children and grandchildren have to pay it. It's woke.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
So welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. So where are we going? Where are we going with this thing? Tom Hartman here with you, by the way. We're seeing gold, which was at 200 and something when Bush came into office, 260, 270, 280, something like that. It's over $500 now. We're seeing gold going through the roof. The price of oil when George W. Bush came into office, $18, $19, $20 a barrel, depending on the day of the week. Now, typically over $60 a barrel. We're seeing the slowest growth in an economy that we have seen literally since the Great Depression. And, where are we going with this economy? And what kind of impact is it going to have over the long term? We're going to come back to this topic and your phone calls in a few minutes. First, Larry Scott is with us. He's the coordinator of VAWatchdog.org, one of the finest websites out there for veterans. Larry Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to speak with you again.
Great to have you back on the program, Larry. What's the news for veterans right now?
Well, there's all kinds of news, and none of it is really good. As you and I had talked about yesterday on your show in Portland, there was a GAO report that just came out. That's from the Government Accountability Office, the nonpartisan accountability arm of Congress.
And a Congress, by the way, which is now controlled by Republicans,
true.
We should add. So if anybody has any doubts about the impartiality of the GAO, that should dispel them.
Right. This is a completely nonpartisan group. But since we spoke yesterday, a second report has come out. So what I'm going to be talking about now is two GAO reports in less than a week that say exactly the same thing. What they say is that for the last 4 years, from 2003 to 2006, the Veterans Administration, the VA, has been cooking the books to make it look like their budget is bigger than it is. And we want, veterans have been saying, well, if you've got all this money, how come we have thousands of veterans on waiting lists, waiting months or even sometimes years for necessary treatment or surgery? It's because they didn't have the money that they claimed they did. And what they did this by accounting manipulation, Enron style is what I like to call it. Basically, VA officials knew that they needed a certain amount of funding to provide health care. But they also knew that the president was only willing to give them so much, which was a lower amount. So what they did was they cooked the books to make it look like they could get by with that lower amount. They made up what they called management efficiencies. These management efficiencies, the GAO found, didn't exist.
Now, hang on just a second. Let me just get this straight.
Okay.
The Bush administration says... we really need we need to spend say $100 million,
mm-hmm.
But we're only going to ask Congress for $90 million,
mm-hmm.
because we're pretty sure we can get $100 million worth of work done with $90 million and
right.
$10 million worth of management efficiencies.
That's exactly right. These so-called management efficiencies. They never.
But the management efficiencies was just a word they made up. They pulled this thing out of their left ear.
Or some other, yes.
Yeah, some other bodily part, yeah.
Right, and exactly right. It was on paper. They didn't exist. So what they did was, instead of taking, the higher amount, they accepted the lower amount. And, of course, what happened is they ran out of money in the middle of the year or even earlier than that, and veterans were left without health care. Right now, the conservative estimate of looking at the books for the last 4 years is at least $4 billion were shorted to the VA because of the way they cook their books. That means $4 billion worth of health care that veterans did not receive.
Now, Larry Scott of VAWatchdog.org, why would the Veterans Administration cook their books? Was this because some political hack from the Bush administration was put in charge of doing this, and they wanted to have more money available for tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, or was this some sort of dumb accounting error?
This was not a dumb accounting error. The GAO indicated that the political appointees who run the VA, remember, all of the higher-ups in all of the departments, and even in the public affairs, the public relations department, are all Bush political appointees. They knew what the White House was willing to give, and they adjusted the budget accordingly. It was strictly a political manipulation so that the White House wouldn't look bad for offering a lower amount of money. In other words, it made it look like the VA and the White House were on the same track. Veterans get health care. Everything's fine. Strictly a political move, nothing else.
But this seems so short-sighted, Larry Scott. I mean, here they are screwing the veterans. I mean, they're underfunding their program. Didn't they think it would come out?
Well, didn't they think the Medicare drug plan would come out once people tried to sign up? Didn't they think we'd find out about Medicaid cuts or cuts to school funding? Things like that.
I think they must be thinking that Americans just aren't paying attention.
They're doing it, you know, it's exactly right, and they're doing this with impunity. They really are, and it's a very sad situation.
Are the veterans groups like the VFW calling them on this?
Yes, they are, as a matter of fact. A lot of the groups are calling them out, and then yesterday, of course, or 2 days ago, rather, was budget day. We got the president's budget, and it's all in nice wrapping. It's like a nice Christmas present with nothing inside. There are big numbers that don't make sense. Once you start analyzing the numbers on the new VA budget, you find out that this so-called $3.5 billion increase in health care isn't. It's all, and again, the management efficiencies are included in there again, believe it or not.
Even after the GAO comes out twice,
yes,
and says this is BS, this is nonsense?
Exactly right. So we've got a bad budget for veterans again this year, Tom.
Incredible. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. You can get the whole story over at the website, VAWatchdog.org. Larry, thanks a lot for coming on the program and for the great work you're doing with and for the veterans of this country.
Thank you, Tom.
Good speaking with you. 27 minutes past there. We'll be back with your calls right after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been there, done that. I ain't looking back on the seas I've sown. Saving times, spending too much time on the telephone.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Telling the truth to multinational corporations. I would really rather you didn't know all about. Good to be back with you. I've been kind of bouncing off this piece that Mike Whitney wrote over at the Information Clearinghouse. He talks about how the Clinton strategy would have made the transition. We're talking about the transition basically from a strong society with a strong middle class and a strong and vibrant democracy like we had in the United States from the mid-30s as we started to climb out of the Great Depression as a result of Roosevelt's policies right up until the 1980s when Ronald Reagan declared war on the middle class. And he points out, as I've been saying for 3 years on this program and for a lot longer than that in other venues, that Bill Clinton was part of this as well, with NAFTA and GATT, the World Trade Organization, the Telecommunications Act, his Clinton's failure to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act. Also, the last president to do that was Jimmy Carter, you know, breaking up AT&T. Last time we saw that, Mike Whitney is suggesting that what we're about to see is a gradual transition, which has been taking 25 years, turn into a very rapid transition with a rapid descent into tyranny under the Bush administration. I sure hope he's wrong. I really do. My sense of it is that Americans are starting to wake up, and it's going to get increasingly difficult. And the fact that Republicans in the United States Senate are starting to blow back against some of the policies of this administration is one of the things that gives me a lot of hope. Another article, this in the Associated Press, war costs, defense budget rising. Country's two overseas wars and its homeland defense could cost as much as $10 billion a month this year, 50% more than last year. This from testimony by Rumsfeld. And you look at the cost of war. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. And at the same time, Bush, this from the Associated Press, if President Bush gets his way, the venerable $255 Social Security death benefit will fade into history, and 16- and 17-year-old high school dropouts will lose their monthly survivor payments. So, you know, the death benefit, this is the widows and orphans portion of Social Security. Bush wants to do away with it. By the way, it was set at $255 back in 1952, when $255 was actually enough money for most people to live on for a month or two. You know, it was like, we'll just get you by, you know, through the mourning period. In fact, the original payments were made right to the funeral homes, pay for the funeral and take care of everything and help you get through, you know, somebody dying. The Bush administration wants to do away with that. I'm telling you, they want to turn Social Security into a welfare program, and you're seeing, in all probability, another attempt, as Bush tried with his last attempt to privatize Social Security, another attempt to means test Social Security, to turn it from an entitlement program into essentially a welfare program, because it's always easy to attack and dismantle welfare programs. After all, they're only for the poor, whereas entitlement programs that are for everybody, a little harder to go after. 1-866-440-8466. Vince in Newcastle, Pennsylvania on line 3. Hey, Vince, welcome to the program.
Tom, I think there'll be a lot more cuts. I'm glad to hear you're optimistic. I'm very pessimistic with Bush's policy for three reasons. First of all, his tax cut he wants to make permanent will bring about $800 billion for the top 1% of the people in income over the next 10 years.
I agree, Vince, and that's why I don't think he's going to get it through. I think that the Republicans are starting to defect. You've got the traditional moderate Republicans, Lincoln Chafee, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, George Voinovich. They're starting to say, enough already, we're bailing ship.
Well,
and he won't have enough votes to get it through the Senate.
I hope you're right, but I don't see that. And the second thing, I think, is his energy policy. When Cheney brought in the private sector people from Halliburton and others and wouldn't name them, and that now we pay $2.50 a gallon for gasoline, and we import more oil now than we did in the year 2000 from the dictatorships and the cartels.
Oh, yeah, it's up about 8%.
Yep, and third, the war. I mean, this budget doesn't even include over $100 billion more he's asking.
That's right.
It's just ridiculous. I mean, our children... Right now, it's $27,000 per person, every child, every person.
Well, it depends on how you calculate it, Vince. If you include the interest that has to be paid on the debt before the debt is repaid, mm-hmm. it's almost $100,000 a person. When a child is born in the United States, they have almost $100,000 birth tax compliments
right.
of Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. And I'd pull Bill Clinton out of that to a certain extent, because although I think that his foreign trade policies were insane, his domestic... economic policies were actually quite rational, and they brought us the first surpluses we'd seen in a long time.
Right. AARP, on the front cover of it, it's $156,000 per person when they use all the accrued liabilities forthcoming. But
yeah.
Nevertheless, his policies are just really geared for the upper class and the top 1% of the population, and the poor, the middle class is going to disappear. We're going to be like Latin American countries. And the poor aren't going to get a thing.
You're absolutely right, Vince. And what's amazing is that traditionally Americans knew this. They knew that the GOP was the party of the rich business class and the class of inherited wealth. And they were always portrayed as the fat cats and the cartoons. I mean, the GOP was proud of it. And then they discovered they could never win an election that way. And so they discovered that if they took a couple of wedge issues, gay marriage, for example, or flag burning, or, you know, Willie Horton playing on racism, if they could take a couple of wedge issues and play on the worst elements of human nature, that they could then win elections, and if they could simply get us to stop talking about economics. And that's why it's so important that we come back to it over and over and over again. Vince, thanks so much for the call. It's good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Dave in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
I'm coming more and more to relate to the sentiments of an organization, The World Can't Wait. So much harm is coming at us at such a pace from these cons.
Yeah, worldcan'twait.org is the website.
Yes, their arrogance, though, it's based, I'm sure, I'm convinced of it, completely on their knowledge that they can make these voting machines do whatever they want them to do. If they want each one to cheat by 10,000 votes, they can make it happen. We've got to get rid of those things. We've got to get our...
I agree with you, Dave.
We've got to get our congressmen all aware of it. I don't even hear many of the Democrats seeing this as a major issue.
I know. It's incredible. They have their head in the sand. It's really tragic. So many of these guys, I think it's that they can't allow themselves to believe that anybody could be that corrupt. And that's why you have to position it. And in fact, I think probably there's more reality to this than to the, you know, gee, the Republicans are running the machines theory anyway. But that's why we have to position it as these machines are not secure. And this software is in the hands of private for-profit corporations who won't allow us to see it, and that's wrong.
We need 10,000 people in front of the Capitol with big signs saying, it's the voting machine, stupid.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Dave. Thanks a lot for the call and for raising the point. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Wow, your last caller was awesome. It read my mind. Yeah, and if these corporate fascists are hell-bent on destroying the United States of America, you know, through vote fraud, phony military adventures, religious zealots, you name it, then an uprising is in order. I mean, not seeing.
Well, I think the uprising is going to happen in November in the ballot box, David. And speaking of the last Dave who called, you know, I hope that enough of us turn out in enough numbers and we get some decent exit polls and we publicize those exit polls well enough this time that even if they try to steal the election, they can't pull it off.
Right. I mean, not seen since before Vietnam. I mean, look how much time went by before, you know, the streets were filled with protesting.
You'll recall, David, in 2002, before George Bush, back when he was saying, no, I don't think we're going to go into Iraq. You know, in fact, here's George W. Bush.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
He said that a month after the Downing Street memo shows he'd already decided to go into Iraq. But what my point is that the number of people who came out into the streets to protest his attack into Iraq was the greatest number of people in the United States history, the greatest number of people coming out in public protests, I mean, even larger than Vietnam War, and around the world was the largest number of people in the history of the planet. And that energy is still out there, David.
That's awesome. Just
needs to be channeled.
And the other point I want to mention, I'm still fuming about how the number one law enforcement person in Albert Gonzalez was not sworn under oath.
Yeah, it's incredible. If you go into a courtroom in the United States and you're being prosecuted by Alberto Gonzalez, the first thing they're going to do is tell you to raise your right hand.
I mean, the Judiciary Committee, Justice, sworn under oath. I mean, what's wrong with this picture here?
Yeah, it's a very sad and tragic day for democracy in America. But the good news, David, is Americans are starting to wake up, and the media is starting to wake up and starting to get a spine. And there's programs like this, and Air America, and Jones Radio, there are voices pushing back now, and they're getting traction. For example, the morning show that I do in Portland, Oregon, on KBOJ, it's always either the number one or the number two AM morning show has been for the last year, on the ratings. I mean, these kinds of we just saw just got the report from one of our affiliates in the Midwest, 46% increase in rating. I mean, it's not like, you know, pat myself on the back. This is happening right across the board with progressive talk radio. People are listening and they're saying, hey, wait a minute, we know there's something wrong, we're not sure exactly what it is, let's talk about it. And the media, the internet media, you know, we're seeing Buzzflash growing like crazy, Common Dreams growing like crazy, Op-Ed News, Information Clearinghouse, and oddly enough, even conservatives like Paul Craig Roberts, former associate editor of the Wall Street Journal, are coming out and saying the Bush cabal is toxic to the United States, and what we're looking at is the possible end of democracy if we don't do something soon.
But vote fraud, Tom. Vote fraud. We have.
Yeah. No. I was the guy who wrote the first article on this three and a half years ago, David. It was called "If You Want to Win an Election, Just Own the Voting Machines." So I'm right there with you, and you know we do need to be doing something about that as well. David, thanks a lot for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, exposing the con in conservative.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
'Cause there's you and me, and all other people, nothing to do, nothing to lose, and it's you.
Aaron, here's your good news for the day. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. In the 132nd Congressional District in the state of Missouri, George W. Bush carried 71% of the vote in 2004, the fourth most conservative district in the entire state house, part of Roy Blunt's district. And yet here is the news. In a stunning victory, Charlie Dake, a Democrat, won one of the most conservative districts in rural southwest Missouri, the 132nd in Lawrence County. To put things in perspective, John Kerry only received 28.5% of the vote in 2005, and Matt Blunt got over 71%. This district is right in Matt Blunt's backyard. It just goes to show that the people that know Matt the most voted for the Republicans the least. This is from Daily Kos. Matt Blunt is Roy Blunt's son, by the way. Frustration with Matt Blunt was also evident in St. Louis County, where General Frank received 48% of the vote, in an area where Matt Blunt carried 56%. And Michael Frame also captured victory in the 105th District in Jefferson and Jefferson counties. He's a Democrat, and he took it with 52%. So here we have three seats in and thanks to Placidus Roy, by the way, in the chat room for popping this up for me, you know, letting the folks in the chat room know about it. He didn't pop up a window on me. He says, Missouri, Senator, terrible news for the Missouri GOP, three heavily Republican districts. Dems retained a state House seat, picked up another, and came within a sliver of winning the last. Miss Silver at the Daily Kos. So I'm telling you, there is good news. By the way, Elaine in Eureka, California, I got a message from Tom over at KGOE, which is the radio station you're listening on. And he runs that station. He would like to hear from you, or whoever the caller was, about the lifetime probation case. So somebody could give KGOE a call. Yeah. Whoever called. Was that you, Elaine, who called about that?
Yes, I will call him.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Okay, and that's what you called about, right?
Yes.
Okay, thanks a lot. Yeah, just give him a shout. Margaret in Eureka, speaking of KGOE, Margaret in Eureka, California. Hey, Margaret.
Hi. Good, Tom. I really enjoy your show. You know, I hear these people call in and to talk shows, and they say that they don't care if the government spies on them. After all, they don't have anything to hide. But they miss the point. We all want the government to spy on the terrorists, but we want a paper trail. So I want to say it like the other guy did. It's the paper trail, stupid.
Well said. Well
yeah,
said.
But it's
not just a paper trail, Margaret, because the Diebold machines that they hacked down in Leon County, Florida, were actually optical scanners. You fill out the paper thing, and then the machine reads it. And then when the machine read it, it didn't say what the paper said.
You know, I'm sorry. I didn't say the first thing I should have said, which is this is about wiretapping.
Yeah.
That's where we really, I mean, without any kind of controls on them, they can just spy on anyway. And these people don't get it that they can spy on political opponents and protesting groups with impunity. And they,
yeah, what we need to say to the conservatives is, do you want President Hillary Clinton spying on you?
I know, you know.
When you're trying to be politically active?
I know, but they don't get it. I've heard that question posed, and they all say, oh, yeah, well, I don't care. If it's the same situation, they can do it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
They really don't care.
Yeah, wait until their conversations are being reposted on the Internet. It's Margaret, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Keith in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Thank you so much for being there for us. I keep hearing these right-wing pundits say how cutting taxes is going to increase revenue. And I heard you a while back go through the numbers of what actually happens. I'm wondering if you can tell me where I can find that information so that we can all fight back and go, no, no, instead of just calling them liars, going, look, here are the numbers. Here's what really happened.
Wow. It's a tough one because it depends on what the measurement is that you're using, whether you're talking about GDP or whether you're talking about government revenues. And when you're talking about government revenues, you have to keep in mind that the books are, you know, terribly, terribly cooked by these guys. I'm not sure exactly where to send you, Keith, but we do periodically have those kinds of numbers here on the program, and I'll have to poke around. We'll put David Poole on this, our producer, and we'll get something for you tomorrow.
You went through a whole list, and it was just amazing.
Reagan, you know, when Reagan cut the budget, I mean, you know, this is no secret. I mean, when Reagan cut taxes, what happened was we started having budget deficits. In fact, all you have to do is look at any of the sites. I mean, the Wall Street Journal had a graph 4 days ago, I think, or 3 days ago, what day is today? Wednesday. It was in the Monday Wall Street Journal. They had a graph that showed budget deficits, and you know, there's nobody will argue with you that Bill Clinton was the first president who didn't have a budget deficit. Well, there you go. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton raised taxes, and suddenly government was working. We didn't have a deficit. We had good times. Things were going very well. And you look at, you know, Reagan just, you know, threw us into a horrible recession and threw us into a terrible budget deficit. And this year, we're going to pay $160 billion in taxes to pay off the interest on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up to try and make the economy look like it was working so he could get himself and other Republicans elected. And so it's not like there's a secret. I don't have a magic number to give you. I just say, you know, Google around on this stuff and find it, and we'll continue to be talking about it in this program.
Thank you so much.
Sorry, I don't have the here's the five magic words, and that's the problem. You know, conservatives they'll try and give you the five magic words, and they're not real. They will say, oh, it's just, you know, you cut taxes, you increase revenue. Not true, first of all. But in any case, Dave in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Dave.
Yes, Tom, I wanted to talk to you about, you mentioned the, when you were talking to Ravi Batra about the, I think I heard something about, it could be a coming depression.
Yeah, he said that it would be possible that we could slide into one. We could be on the edge of it right now.
Okay, I'll make this quick then. What I was going to say is the backbone of the safety net would be family farms.
Yeah, well, and they're gone. Actually, family farms were the safety net in the 30s. The safety net now is manufacturing, and that's gone as well. Thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Marlo Lewis, conservative Marlo Lewis, is going to debate me on why a windfall profit tax. Marlo says it only hurts the oil industry, and it's a bad thing. Lynn Landis is going to be talking about the voting process. She's got a case going to the Supreme Court. That and more, and your calls. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.